Thank you, Simon, and good morning to all of you. Welcome back to our board meeting. We opened the second day with the session on the PIR on IFRS 10 to 12, and I hand over to Jing.
Thank you, Andreas. Good morning, everyone. It was last December when the board published the request for information on post-implementation review of IFRS 10, 11, 12, with a comment period ended on this May. Agenda paper 7 summarizes feedback on the request for information, and there are four papers. Agenda paper 7A summarizes feedback from comminators on IFRS 10. 7B summarizes feedback from comminators on IFRS 11 and IFRS 12, and includes other matters raised by the respondents. Feedback from the outreach activities is summarized in 7C, and finally, 7D provides an update on the academic literature review. The board is not asked to make any decisions at this meeting, and I'll highlight overall feedback before the board discussion. For IFRS 10, many respondents agree with control as a single basis for consolidation, and they've acknowledged the need for judgment and have highlighted that in complex arrangements, applying judgments and making decisions on control can itself be challenging. As a consequence, some respondents to the request for information highlighted the importance of application guidance and illustrated examples. Most of the respondents who answered the question related to investment entity have said that in some situations, it can be challenging to apply the definition of an investment entity. Furthermore, they also raised concern about the loss of information when an investment entity measures at fair value a subsidiary that is itself an investment entity. For IFRS 11, stakeholders agree with the principle in the standard that is classifying the joint arrangement based on rights and obligations. They highlighted the usefulness of the agenda decisions in applying IFRS 11, and some respondents asked for the agenda decisions to be incorporated to the text of the standard. Many stakeholders said the collaborative arrangement outside the scope of IFRS 11 are common in certain industry sectors. Most of these respondents said to account for these arrangements, an analogy is made to joint operation accounting in IFRS 11. However, some respondents said the equity method is applied. For IFRS 12, feedback from outreach activities said the disclosure standards have significantly improved the financial reporting. However, there are requests, particularly from users, for additional information. This is the overall feedback on the request for information. The staff will ask the board at a future meeting to decide how to respond to the feedback. That is, what, if any, actions to take as a result of this post-implementation review. With that, I'll hand over to the board for discussion. We are particularly interested in hearing comments on the summary of the feedback and your views on what actions, if any, the board might consider as the next step of this project. Thank you.
Thank you, Jing. And let me just ask one question before I open it up. Do you want to take it in stages and say we go by standard 10, 11, 12, or would you just open up everything at this stage?
I would say we can open up for any suggestions.
Okay.
Because we already prioritized some of the matters in our request information. So, yeah.
Okay. So, board members, floor is open. And please.
Thanks, Andreas. Thanks, Jing, and the team for the papers and this excellent work. I think you've been extremely efficient in your gathering of a great deal of information in response to the RFI. I think that this very detailed feedback is helpful. It covers the several standards and many issues that you've looked at. And so it's very encouraging to see the positive feedback that's come through and that you've worked hard to identify for us in a clear way areas that we can think about. So I think going forward, when you ask us, you know, how feedback from the board on what to do next, how to respond, I'd like to know more about the impact or the effect of these areas where we could potentially do something. So within the feedback you already have, I'd like to have more information on some of these things. So for example, you've clearly identified areas where people are asking for more guidance, illustrative examples or clarity in definitions, standard setting where the standards are not clear or they're silent, and in some cases more disclosure about judgments, the assumptions that have been used and some specific topics. Now, I know you don't want to do further work, further outreach, but within the feedback you've got, if you could give us more information about the effect of whatever people were saying. So, you know, if it's something like there's a whether style standards are silent or not clear, you know, what's the outcome of that? So I think you referred to it in your tee up because you said that because collaborative arrangements are outside scope of 11, people are looking to use joint operations accounting or equity method accounting. So can we understand more about that? That's an example of trying to understand more. So is there more data to back up that kind of information that you've given us? Because I think the board at some point has to be able to prioritise issues, have to work out where we want to focus. And indeed, I know you've said in the paper 7 that we have to do this within the constraints of agenda consultation as well. So it's not just this list of things, trying to work out which of those has the most impact and therefore should get the attention. We need information, more information about the areas to enable us to make decisions vis-a-vis all the other competing projects. So I think I'm asking for more information on the topics to help us understand their importance to make decisions about prioritising things before proceeding with work. But great job with the papers, thank you, and great job with getting all that feedback for us. So thank you.
Thanks, Anne. Mary, please.
Thanks, Andreas. And my first comment actually is directed at both Zen and at you, Andreas, because I have some overall comments that I'd like to make now. And I wanted to suggest, Andreas, that we pick up on the suggestion that you made. Maybe if we do one pass through with people's overall reactions like Anne's, and I'll give some of my high level ones. But then maybe if we look at paper 7A and 7B, and 7C, each of those separately, it might help us not cross across too much again and again. If the team doesn't mind, I think that may help. So for my overall comments, the first one is about the need for judgment. That this is a recurring theme in many of the areas, and I don't think we're surprised. I think the work that the team did in phase one identified a lot of areas for which people might ask for more guidance, more examples, etc. I think it's very good that we had acknowledgement coming back in the responses to the PIR that in difficult and complex arrangements there will be judgment necessary. I think the question that we should be asking ourselves and ask the staff to assess when they bring back recommendations is the guidance adequate considering the overall balance of complexity that more guidance and examples adds versus the frequency of the fact patterns for which people said more guidance, more examples might be helpful. So, because I think that potential for additional complexity is maybe underrated by those who are dealing with the most complex arrangements, but it's a cost that's imposed on everybody who uses the standards. So I think it's good that there's overall buy-in to the fact that there has to be judgment applied. I think we should be asking ourselves whether the feedback we get is indicative that the objective or the framework or the main considerations for making the judgment in that area, is it that it's inadequate, or is it just that it's hard? And we should acknowledge that it's going to be hard. And I would expect that it would be exceptional rather than the norm that we respond by giving more guidance or assessment. So I've talked about what I think the objective should be. If I look at investment entities as a, as another subject, I think investment entities probably is an area where I'd expect that we'd identify for further work. I'm not speaking to the priority of it vis-a-vis other things that come in via the agenda consultation, but in terms of the review of this batch. And I guess I am, when I look at the overall, the feedback, my overall comment in this area is I think we don't want to do a fundamental change in approach. And I would include in the fundamental change an idea of saying it's basically a designation or intent of management and nothing more. And the reason I raise that is, frankly, I think that's the only way we could respond to the comments that said intermediate companies that might be there for legal, tax, or regulatory purposes allow in certain circumstances things to be consolidated, but allow in other circumstances for the fair, you know, for fair value. I think we have in past standard setting work tried really hard to think about exactly those factors and concluded that we could not come up with, you know, objective criteria. So the only way to respond to those requests, you know, to do what people say they think would be most useful is basically to say use of the investment entity exemption would be a management choice and designation. So in this area, while I do think we probably need to do something, I think we should be focusing on whether there are kind of subsections of the what people reported as the potential for loss of information, et cetera, where we can think about how the criteria work and if there is clarification that would help with that. And one thing that comes to mind is whether a subsidiary investment entity should be consolidated rather than reported at fair value. But I don't think we should be identifying this as a fundamental reconsideration of investment entities on a designation basis. The third kind of big picture point that came out to me on collaborative arrangements, this is another area for which I get the sense that staff thinks that some further work is an appropriate potential project. And I did think that one of the points that was in there that really came out at me is that we will have to focus on the legal structure. And that's some of the thinking that's in IFRS 11 as well, because it's really hard for me to see if you have a collaborative arrangement that is outside the scope of IFRS 11 and it is not in a legal entity, how you could conclude as one of the contractors to that collaborative arrangement that you have some kind of significant influence over the entirety of the arrangement when there's not a legal entity and when it is an entirely contractual arrangement. And that is what, you know, and having some kind of influence over the entirety of the arrangement is what equity method implies to me. And then a fourth point, and then I'll make an overall comment. Fourth point is the encouragement to incorporate agenda decisions. I think it's an interesting observation. I think it's something that the board should consider separately from this PIR and make a universal decision about and not start in the context of one project or one PIR to do one thing in terms of how we take agenda decisions and take a different approach in for different standards and areas. So I guess I would identify that as something the board should consider as an overall question about whether we do or whether we don't do that. And then the last kind of overall point is I step back and ask myself, how much do we think there's a need to react and do, you know, identify possible standard setting projects? I'm not saying do something, because that I think goes into the priority issue for the agenda consultation. And my overall reaction is relatively little. I've hit on the ones just now where I think are, you know, the headlines of the areas where I think potential further projects should be considered. When we go to a group of people and say, we're doing a PIR, tell us where there are problems. Of course, people come up with a list, you know, of problems. But, you know, I think we ask good questions about frequency, impact, et cetera. And when I take the totality of the information we get back, there's not, you know, people said these are the problems, but they sometimes they're saying it would be really nice to have more help with them. But overall, they were saying a single model for control works. IFRS 11 in general works. Here are things at the margins with IEs, collaborative arrangements, where we're having some problems. And let's make sure we don't overreact, because I think that would, you know, misallocate our resources. So that's kind of my deep dive on big picture issues. Thank you.
Thank you, Mary. And I would take up your advice of saying, let's do one round of general comments. So if board members do have particular comments on IFRS 10, 11, and 12, let's park these and do them in a second and third round. With that, let's hear from Tadeo.
Thank you, Andreas. Thanks to staff for preparing these papers with the summary of the feedback received. This PIR is a big one. Actually, we're talking about three standards, and it will be a very hard task for the staff to put together the information to help us as a board to decide whether and where we should do any standard setting work. I think that this comment is totally aligned what Anne said. I mean, that Anne's concern in relation to the information that we may need to make a decision. It's a lot of information all together. We just need to put them and think whether we should do something or not. Another comment, very much in line also with what Mary said. I realized that when I start making some work in the paper, realized that the majority of the topics discussed on this one, just to take an example, the 7A, most of the respondents said that IFRS 10 gives the answer to the accounting treatment. And then some ask for more guidance referring to some challenging situations. I think that definitely we have to be very careful to avoid including guidance when this is not necessary. Again, in line what Mary said, the standards are principle-based, and it's supposed that in some cases, management will need to exercise their judgment in more difficult situations. I agree that in some cases it can be really challenging, but I'm afraid that adding guidance to address specific situations, and we have already said this in other meetings here, may lead us to review the standards every time that we have new transactions or it become common. It doesn't mean we should not add guidance for some, but I would be very careful when assessing the need for additional guidance. And one topic that I just want to emphasize here, and it is good just to take this spectrum that most of the answers were that IFRS 10 is working properly. But in some cases, the feedback indicates situation that's not related to the judgment challenges. For example, investment entities, I think that is a clear message in relation to measuring at fair value investments in a subsidiary that is itself an investment entity, indicates there is an important loss of information. And for example, this is an area that I think we staff should indeed consider when preparing the paper related to the direction of the project. For this paper, these are my comments. Thank you.
Thank you, Tadeo. Bertrand.
Thank you, Andreas. Yes, I agree with the others that I've just spoken, that the papers are comprehensive and provide a good overall feedback or a good overall summary of all the feedbacks received. Mary and Tadeo, I think effectively judgment is totally inherent to those subjects of appreciating the control, the joint control, and even the significant influence of another entity. And from my recent previous experience, we had no difficulties in applying this judgment to the cases we encountered. So I think the standards work well, and we never didn't find an answer to a specific case in not applying or in applying the principles contained in the standards. And then that is for my very general comments, and I have more specific comments on some specific situations described in the papers.
Thank you, Bertrand. Jinzhao, please.
Thanks, Andreas. I also thank staff for prepare this this excellent paper. To us, just two general comments. First is about the demanding from stakeholders on additional application guidance and other material examples as well. I share same concerns as Mary, Tadeo, and Bertrand said that because the objective of PII is to test whether IFRS 10, 11, and 12 worked as the board intended. I think when the board developed those three standards, particularly IFRS 10, 11, we have intended that those new concepts, for example, control or joint control will require significant judgment. So it's not a surprise for us to receive those comments and feedback. So it's for me, I think it is not unexpected to feedback. And so therefore, how to respond to those demand on those additional guidance and illustrated examples. I also think that we should be careful, And one sometimes, even we introduced new guidance and examples, maybe stakeholders still demand, more, and judgment is still needed. So in the case, if really those additional guidance and examples really can reduce the diversity and can really enhance the consistent application, I think we can work on. Otherwise, if further judgment is still needed, and I think we should be careful. So this is the first general comment. Second general comment about agenda decision made by our interpretation committees. I see several areas that stakeholders would like to incorporate agenda decisions made by our interpretation committees to the standards. I'm not sure what's the object, because because agenda decision made consistent with the requirements of the standard itself. It could not change any requirement of itself, the standard itself. So I'm not sure what's the meaning of the incorporation of those agenda decision into the standard as a requirement or as a non-mandatory examples or what else, because we cannot change the requirements simply including those agenda decisions. So it doesn't help. If we would like to introduce more examples, maybe understandable, but we all still need to be careful. Once we introduce most examples, whether really it help to enhance the consistent application into the standards itself. Obviously, I think I acknowledge that agenda consultation decision help stakeholders to implement standard itself. It's no problem, but we should be careful to incorporate those agenda decision into the standard itself. And I remember one of the reasons it seemed that some stakeholders would like to have those agenda decision to be incorporated standards to make those agenda decision aware of those stakeholders. If simply would like to make awareness of those agenda decisions, I think we can do, for example, do other ways, provide some kind of webinar, education session, some other things. And it may not be relevant to how to improve our standards itself. So I think this is another thing the staff can explore further, and how can we deal with those concerns relating to agenda decisions. Thank you.
Thank you, Jinzhao. And given that both you and Mary had commented on the agenda decisions, I see that Jen wanted to comment on that. So I pass back to him for this. Jen, please.
Thank you, Andreas. Thank you, Jinzhao and Mary. And for the agenda decision issue, I think the main comments made by the respondents is about the accessibility of the agenda decisions, because they mentioned that not everyone have access to the annotated version of the IFRS standards, things like that, and they also need to pay for the annotated page version of the standard. So it's an accessibility problem. It's not a conflict between the standard and agenda decisions. It's only about how they can easily access the agenda decisions and apply it according to what the agenda decision suggests to apply the standard.
Thank you for the clarification on that one. I think one comment that Mary made probably still remains valid, that this is probably not an issue that is isolated and only applies to IFRS 10, 11 and 12, but probably more across the board, and therefore should be reviewed by the board more holistically. Okay, thank you. We continue with the round, with the first round. Sue, please.
Thanks. And just on that agenda decision point, I agree some people find those agenda decisions hard to find, but just to be clear, they are all available at no charge on our website, so you don't have to buy a bound volume to get them. They are there, although they may not be the easiest to locate. I do agree with that. I just wanted to firstly say thank you for the papers. I think the papers did a really good job of pulling the feedback together in a very balanced and coherent way. So good job from the staff. And just a couple of high-level points. Just one really 30,000-level point is, I think that the feedback that we've got really shows the benefit of allowing some period of time for the dust to settle before we do a post-implementation review. Because if I think back to some of the comments I was hearing in the early days of all of these standards, there was quite a lot of angst in the market. And you can see how with, you know, just the passage of time, people getting used to concepts, things have calmed down. And so we're really able to see now what really tricky areas remain, and we've sort of lost the noise from the system. So I think the timing looks good to me. So that's one positive to note. Just in terms of other sort of high-level comments, quite a few people have asked for more materials to help them understand concepts and for educational material, and I think we should be open to doing that. But I think we should try, and this is for the staff to think about, try and sort of identify areas where there's something we can really say that's new and that will really aid understanding. So, for example, if I look at a topic like the confusion that seems to exist about the sort of notion of a protective right versus the notion of a substantive right, which are quite different concepts, but they seem to get intermingled, that might be a candidate for where some extra explanation or educational material might help people. Whereas I think we could add another 20 examples on how to think about control where you've got less than a majority of votes, and we may not provide much extra information really, and people still probably won't find their fact pattern there. So I think we need to distinguish between where we can really be helpful and where probably there's not that much more we can do if the basic idea is right. And so I think there are some opportunities for those sorts of materials, but we need to tread a little bit carefully. One other observation was in relation to investment entities. So a lot of the things that we're hearing now, I remember, are things that were raised when we originally were working on this project. I think I was on the staff at the time, and we spent hours and hours and hours at the board table and behind the scenes trying to solve a lot of these issues. So really to echo what Mary said, to make sure that we're not reinventing the wheel and that we go back and remember why certain decisions were made, because we were aware of a lot of the consequences back in the day. So let's make sure we don't reinvent the wheel. And I think that was all I had to say for now. Thank you.
Thank you, Sue. Bruce.
Thanks very much. And my thanks to the staff again for a good paper. Just my overall comments, I think, a lot of these have been picked up by everybody already, so I'll try not to repeat too much what they said. I mean, the first one is I'm very encouraged by the fact that the majority of respondents almost on all the questions came back and said that they felt the standards working well. That's been my experience. And on average, I think these, as a group of standards from when I was applying them, I think we managed to get the answers. I think the one thing I would just encourage the staff to do in my mind is, and I expressed the same concern when we looked at the PIR of IFRS 9 yesterday, I expressed the same today, in that I still get worried that whenever people feel that they have to apply judgment, they get concerned that, well, now potentially the stand's not working. So I'll just again encourage the staff to do the same as we did yesterday, and that is that I think we need to distinguish between what are those things that are judgment calls, and we're comfortable to let people make those judgment calls, even if they do end up with slightly different answers, and what are those things where we really need to potentially issue guidance or change the standard on. On these standards, I mean, I accept for, and I know we're going to get into details, especially on IFRS 11, where, I mean, I think there are genuinely some areas we can improve on, and a lot of that came out of the stuff we did on the Interpretations Committee when I was there as well. I think there are areas we can tighten up on those. I just think that the one thing I'm cautious of is these as a group of stands, I think these really work well. And I just wouldn't want us to go out there once again and change things because people are scared of judgment. So I think let's just make sure we're distinguishing between where we really need to do something and where we can say, guys, we're comfortable, people are going to apply their judgment there, and that's the answer that we think gives the right one. Thank you.
Thank you, Bruce. And finally, Erika.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, staff, for excellent analysis about the feedback to kicking off this discussion. And also, thank you for extensive outreach with various stakeholders that will help our future discussion well. And then, so the overall comment, especially about my request to staff about further analysis on the individual issue in the future, generally, I think if regulators think we can do something to enhance the compliance, if they said something particular that they consider we can help their enforcement, please include that in the future paper. And another thing is about the root causes of incompliance in practice. I think maybe there will be two particular root causes. One is probably misunderstanding of the standards, requirements in standards. So in that case, there might be a clarification is necessary. But another thing is probably some difficulties or misjudgment about the materiality. So if that is the case, I'm not really sure how we can help them to improve that area just by clarifying the standards. So if you can see anything about that, please include that insight. But I didn't want to request anything further to do for any additional outreach on that. At this moment, I just want the staff to look into further what we have already received so far through the comment letters as well as your discussion with the stakeholders in outreach meetings or events. That's all. Thank you.
Thank you, Erika. I would just take this opportunity to also show my appreciation about the work done. I think my comments will be very much in line with what I've heard from other board members and saying, don't throw the baby with the bathwater. The fact that there are concerns being flagged to us doesn't mean that the standard isn't working. There is an overall assumption on the contrary that the standards are working as intended. And I completely agree with Sue's comment that it probably was good to see some years passing and the dust settle for us to actually see, is there still something in need of being rectifying? So my general comment would have been that if there was an issue, companies probably needed to react in that particular reporting period where that issue arose. They couldn't have left the books open. They needed to find a solution to the problem. Now, they may have reviewed that solution in the years thereafter, but I would come to the assessment that 5-6 years down the road, they probably have found a solution that's rather stable, meaning that what areas I could think of are in need of rectification. Firstly, any new developments that the board couldn't have anticipated. Not sure how many there were. There may be isolated issues that I may comment on when we get to the individual standards. Then inconsistent application that we've become aware of is certainly an issue that we would want to revisit. Not necessarily act on, but see whether the inconsistency arose because of the way how we worded the issues in the standards. And then there's a third issue that I think may warrant further investigation, which I would call cross-cutting topics. And that refers to the relationship between IFRS 10 and 11 with other standards. And I give you one example that has hit the Interpretations Committee twice. That is the relationship of IFRS 15 and 16 with IFRS 10. And the question was, does revenue recognition change regarding a transaction, whether you push that through an empty shell company or not? And I think the existence or non-existence of companies and even shell companies, I think, is something that may create complexity or may have created complexity inadvertently. And that will be an area that I will be interested in to see whether we can do something to ease complexity. With that, I will pass back to Jen, to the staff, whether you have any general responses apart from the agenda decisions that we have already touched on, what you've heard from board members. Otherwise, I would then open up for the individual standards. But first, Jen, please.
Andres, please go ahead.
Okay. So I would then say, let's go to paper 7A and the PIR on IFRS 10. And I would ask for specific comments. And Mary is first in line, please.
Sorry, I felt I owed that because of having suggested deferring. Let me go through a handful of topics with some more detailed comments. The first is on relevant activities. One of the topics discussed. I think we could think about whether we could resolve some of the comments by commenting on whether an assessment is made based on current conditions only, with, you know, obviously reassessed at reporting dates, or whether at day one you take a whole of life basis using expectations and then only updating as expectation change. But I think I would, you know, that's a thought about how we could maybe respond, going back to one of Sue's comments, where we actually really move the needle on, you know, on issues, because that seems the point. But I'd ask the staff before we start talking about what we could do to, you know, to come back and say, how big an issue do you think this is, and where would you put it in standard setting? In terms of another issue, veto rights and lenders' rights. When you're reading the issue and thinking about it, it becomes tempting to try and comment and resolve. But I then, you know, challenged myself to be disciplined and said, listen, only a few raised it. And so let's really challenge ourselves whether the cost benefit for all stakeholders using IFRS standards makes it worth it. And I think, therefore, I'd say probably not. What I shorthand as de facto control, again, I started thinking about the ability to try and respond to some of this, especially the what you do when there's no voting pattern, et cetera, reminding people that there is a requirement for reassessment. And so presumably that's something where you would build up information. But again, I think we have to ask, did it come up frequently enough to warrant recommending taking action as resources permit. When I get to the subject of link between power and returns, and in particular, principal versus agent and concerns about it being challenging and perhaps costly, when I stood back and thought about it, I thought, this is an assessment that presumably you only make once at the beginning of the accounting for the relationship and would update only if you had a change in the agreement, because this is one where you're trying to decide whether or not you're acting as an agent. So the fact that there may be some higher upfront cost for assessing a complex negotiated relationship doesn't strike me as inappropriate. And in terms of the suggestion about can we give guidance about how to weight the factors, I'm going to hark back to Sue's caution about where can we add value, because I don't see how we can give in the abstract guidance about the weighting of factors that's supposed to apply across all kinds of situations, all kinds of industries, in what are very often quite tailored, quite heavily negotiated arrangements. So I think instead, and this is a theme I found myself going back to a number of times throughout all the papers, is we may be wanting to highlight that these significant judgments are ones that should be considered as requiring disclosure under IS1's requirement for disclosure of significant judgments. What was, if it was a difficult, complex assessment, what was the judgment that you made about whether you are a principal or an agent or that gives transparency to the users to understand. And the same thing applies with the related party questions that are covered in question 3B3. And then I think the last thing I'll say is investment entities I already covered in the big picture comments, but I think that's one for which we probably do want to think about whether there's further work that would be useful. And then we have to stop and say, how does that fit in against all of the rest of our priorities? So those are my 7A comments. Thank you.
Thank you, Mary. Bertrand.
Thank you, Andreas. A couple of specific comments on Agenda Paper 7A. The first one is relating to paragraphs 17 to 21. I think the overall appreciation of control at inception works well, and notably this concept of considering control at the investee's inception, I think it works well. I would tend to think that then if you have been able to design an entity that is then almost working on its own prospectively, and you have elaborated initially this design, there are sufficient elements to appreciate whether you have control or not. And then the question is more whether in prospectively there might be something that you need to reassess in terms of the initial control you had thought of. That's the first comment. The second comment will be on de facto control. There are some criteria listed in paragraph B42AD, and I think the most important paragraph on de facto control is paragraph B46 that states, if it is not clear, having considered the factors listed in paragraph B42AD, that the investee has power, then investor does not control the investee. So it means what? It means that totally in alignment with the conceptual framework, control is a positive assessment. You need to conclude positively that you have control to be in a position to consolidate an entity, even in the case, and notably, in the case of de facto control. Maybe these could be a bit more highlighted in the standard, because I think this paragraph B46 is key in the assessment of de facto control. And then the last comment, and it will probably echoes Andreas' comment on the interaction between some standards and IFRS 10, notably. Actually, when I read paragraph 100b, I was surprised by the or 100, sorry, I was surprised by the recognition of non-controlling interest when you have you acquire an entity which is not considered to be a business. So in a sense, you will account for it as if it were an asset deal, but it's not exactly an asset deal because it is an entity. And then effectively, I was surprised by the fact that you would then recognize non-controlling interest, but I think there is no real other alternative than doing that. And so in my past practice, I've always encountered either asset deals, pure asset deals, whereby you recognize individual assets and all liabilities, or the acquisition of a company and which is a business. Then, so I think this was quite a clear cut between the two. There we are in a gray zone, and effectively it echoes back to the interactions between the recognition of individual assets when those individual assets are incorporated within an entity. And probably it echoes your comment, Andreas, on that.
Thank you, Bertrand, it does. Anne, please.
Thank you, Andreas. I want to comment on the calls for additional guidance and illustrative examples. It's very common in this paper 7A in relation to IFRS 10. And they're coming out of, you know, about 50 comment letters out of a total of 83. And bringing up an issue, the issues that relate to control and then various things falling out of that, and asking for additional guidance on things like relevant activities, rights and powers, de facto relationship, and so on. But I think we have to exercise caution, which I think I've heard others already say. Practice has developed and does develop, and anything we do as a result of a post-implementation review is potentially disruptive to practice. We're also very aware that the examples, they get criticised for being simplistic, and yet we've spent a lot of time on those. Staff spend a great deal of time formulating those examples and trying to find something that fits, that is illustrative, but still fits with the complexity of situations. So I don't really respond to people asking for, you know, better examples or more complicated examples because of the constraints that are there, and I think Mary's already referred to those. It's also a concern that our examples can be misused, and so we hear about that in paragraph 51, where the examples of 13 through 16 of IFRS 10 have been interpreted to give a hard line percentage that applies. And I wasn't on the board at the time these were developed, but I very much doubt that the board's intention was to arrive at a percentage in the range 22 to 37. I have to imagine that's the board's intention. So I'm not sure at this stage what, if anything, we do about that, but it just reinforces, I think, the caution that we need. And I would agree with Mary that, and indeed Sue, that a lot of thought goes into setting up the principles and indeed getting the examples to illustrate those. So I'm not very keen on these calls for additional guidance, other than if we do find something that where we think we can value add because there is something that's missing that I think we have to be very specific in what we're trying to achieve by making any addition to the guidance and the examples. Thank you.
Thanks, Anne. Nick, please.
Thanks, Andreas. So I agree with others. It's important that we're judicious in our considerations of the issues that are being raised by the feedback and the outreach, given the overall sense that the standards are working well. So I'm just going to flag one issue here, which stands out for me. It's one that's already being flagged. I want to lend my support to consideration here. And that's investment entities where subsidiaries are also investment entities. And the words that jump out to me from one of our stakeholders is the sense that our requirements may actually be obscuring performance in some circumstances. And I think that leads me to a wish that we actually look to address this and see if we can come up with something which actually enhances transparency and seems to work under these particular circumstances in the other direction. Thank you.
Thanks, Nick. Jinchao.
Thanks, Andreas. Just two comments. One is relating to veto rights. I had a similar observation as Mary said, that when I look at the paragraph 29 to 31, this sounds like that is a big problem and we needed to resolve it, because it's really whether there is a veto right or not really a matter how to make judgment whether control exists or not. But how can we deal with it? It seems that it's not easy to deal with it without putting into specific circumstances. But when I read paragraph 36, we made reference to a common letter, and that letter also mentioned veto rights. I think that may be a direction for us to move forward to address veto rights and to put into the context of protective rights or substantive rights, whether it's part of protective rights or whether it's part of the substantive rights, maybe could address, at least partly address that concern about arising from veto rights. So this is the first comment. Second comment is about investment entity. You know, currently we require company to measure those investments in a subsidiary that's itself an investment, entity. And there's some concern about loss of information. And when I read the paragraph 73, it seems that, there are many stakeholders raise this issue. You know, 14 national standards, 8 preparers, 7 accounting firms, 7 accounting bodies, and 5 regulators, large numbers. So that means there's a concern about loss of useful information. I wonder, because among those stakeholders, I didn't see users' feedback. If there's some useful information lost, I would like to see the feedback from users. So I understand that Chen and your team also conducted outreach with users, and I wonder if you have any feedback from users' perspective. This would be really useful for us. And secondly, how to address this issue. I think paragraph 77, one of the stakeholders actually provided some kind of solution. Actually, they have done. Actually, they provide additional disclosure, so-called separate non-GAAP investment basis statement of comprehensive income to supplement those information which would be needed by users. I think if we would like to develop some kind of solution to address the concerns of those so many stakeholders raised, maybe provides additional disclosures could help, without a fundamentally changed accounting treatment currently included in the standard. So that's all my two comments. Thank you.
Thank you. And I see that Jen wanted to respond.
Hi, Jen Chao. Thank you. I think the problem is we don't receive many direct response from users. And if my memory is correct, the users, basically, when you see the numbers of the national standard setters, the users make their comments regarding this loss of information issue through the national standard setters. So some of the users are behind these national standard setters. Yeah.
Okay, thanks for the clarification. Bruce?
Thanks, Andreas. Just kind of building on the last comment I made, obviously we're still very in support of the judgment people are applying. There were just two areas in the paper that kind of really jumped out at me that I think we should maybe just have a bit more of a discussion on. The first one is when we've spoken around paragraph 45, when we're looking at control without a majority. The one that interested me was when a lot of commentators came back saying effectively that we really need to look at the cost benefit and that there was a lot of cost attached to making that assessment. I was quite surprised at that because, I mean, I'm not disputing that there can be a cost associated with working out whether you do have control. But I mean, to me, that was quite a fundamental thing, determining whether you have control when you own less than majority. So I'd be interested in understanding the hurdle that people have put in place as to when they would consider it too much cost to determine whether you actually control something, assuming, of course, that, that the subsidiaries we're talking about are material. So I just think that that's one to me that I would just be interested in kind of unpacking a bit more. The other one I have to say that I found in practice was very challenging was around the where we looked at question 3A. Principal agent, especially in the area of fund managers. There's a lot of inconsistency around how fund managers are looking at these types of things, when potentially they have to consolidate something they do, something they don't. That's just an area where I have found that there was kind of, depending on different markets and different people I spoke to, really quite a lot of inconsistency amongst what they were doing. So just one of those areas that we would also probably want to spend a bit of time having a look at. Thank you.
Thanks, Bruce. Over to Sue.
Thanks. Just a few points. And I have to say that I think, again, to praise the staff, I think you've done a really good job of being not overdoing the message of judgment as a problem, but rather focusing on areas where people needed further, perhaps, clarification to understand how to make judgments. And I think that's really helpful because I really agree with the point that Bruce has made yesterday and today about that judgment point. A couple of things to comment on in this paper. One is the investment entities. Of course, when we hear that our requirements are resulting in a reduction in transparency and a loss of information, that's always a cause for concern given what our day job is. But my recollection, and I don't remember the reasons now, it's back in the day, but I remember that we thought really hard about this consolidation point for investment entity subsidiaries, because at the time we were actually working with the FASB and it was a gap difference. So it was something we looked at really, really hard. So we must have had pretty substantive reasons for where we landed. So it's going to be important to remember what those reasons were. We need to look at it hard because, you know, we're all about transparency. But, you know, there was an irony that the whole point of that project was to improve the quality of information, and then we had this sort of counterintuitive outcome. So something to look at, but let's make sure we've got all of the information if and when we do that. One that I was surprised we didn't actually get more feedback on, but I did have a look at the letters and I see a few banks did raise it, which I'm not surprised by, is in the area of unconsolidated structured entities. And given that we wrote IFRS 12 fresh on the sort of heels of the financial crisis, when all we were all so focused on, you know, securitization structures and what had happened in the financial crisis, there was a lot that we did in that space, which really isn't such a thing these days in terms of, you know, information needs that I'm aware of. So I was expecting there to be more people to say we needed to rebalance the requirements in IFRS 12 than we have heard. There's a couple, I can see Michelle shaking her head. I see some of the banks have raised this. It may well mean that, and I'm thinking about it sort of in the context of our disclosure project too as well, because if people have felt that they can apply materiality in a way that actually they get to a good place, that's actually a useful piece of information. So I'd be interested to understand that aspect a bit better in a bit more detail at the appropriate time. The last thing I wanted to touch on was just this point about corporate wrappers and, you know, the effects if you do a transaction without a subsidiary or in a subsidiary, and how you can get different outcomes and the interaction between 10 and 11 and other standards. Obviously, that has come. A couple of questions have come to the Interpretations Committee, and you might remember not that long ago the board actually looked at whether we should do a narrow scope amendment to try and address some of these revenue questions that had come to the board, where there was sort of single purpose entities that only had one property transaction in them, and we concluded that it wasn't the time, or it was difficult to do. While in my heart I can understand why people feel sometimes the outcomes are odd, it's really, really a difficult area. So I just sort of, you know, a little bit of a note of caution from me, I guess. I was a staff member looking after consolidation project back in the day. So in 2002, I had to write papers on, you know, how you get such different outcomes if you've got options over an asset versus options over shares in an entity, and why was that? And there was a big discussion at the time. And in the end, you know, we weren't able to really think of a, you know, a substancey sort of way of making the distinction. And so there's a lot of history for why it matters that there's a corporate there. So while in my heart I can see how it seems a bit jarring because you can get such stark outcomes, just a note of caution from me about how difficult a path that is to tread.
Point well taken. Thank you. Rika.
Sorry to take a moment to unmute myself. I think I try to not be addressed, but other board member already mentioned. So I think I fully agree with the point raised by other board members, especially about how to apply the judgment when the case in IFRS 10. And then I think based on my experience, how difficult it was before, but once the judgment have been made in the practice, I think it's more important to have the consistent application of the same way of thinking of applying the requirement in a similar situation. So I think what the staff want to see a little bit on in connection with those items is if there any good evidence or feedback that we can see and understand how good disclosure provided to the investor in connection with the judgment the entity made, especially about those old points we have included in RFI, that will be very helpful to consider our further action, including, I think, Jinja already mentioned about the enhancement of the disclosure or improvement in it. So, thank you.
Thank you, Rika. We do have just a bit under half an hour left. I suggest that we spend around 20 minutes on IFRS 11 and reserve 10 minutes for IFRS 12 so that nothing gets lost. And I think if board members still do have comments that they wish to part with the staff, I mean, you can also do that, obviously, outside of the meeting, and we will see these papers back at a later stage anyway. Okay, can I then open the floor for comments on IFRS 11, please? Tadeo, please.
Thank you, Andreas. I think that one important point, I believe, that is in this, when we discuss IFRS 11, is the collaborative arrangements outside the scope of the standard. My understanding is that the feedback confirmed the divesting practice due to the lack of guidance with application of IFRS 11 by analogy or equipment based on IS 28. It is not clear from the feedback, especially considering the low level of responses about the faithful representation, whether the accounting policy selected reflect the facts and circumstances of the arrangement. And this concern is confirmed by the feedback that in some cases, the legal structure was the main drive of the accounting policy. Also, some regions said that collaborative arrangements are not common in their jurisdiction. I would really take this feedback carefully, as I believe that even the definition of collaborative arrangements might not be clear. And actually, it might be occurring in these jurisdictions, but it's not a problem as they are simply looking at them within the scope of IFRS 11 or IS 28. And finally, still in relation to the collaborative arrangements, I'm wondering whether this topic should be developed as part of this project or of a separate project, depending on the feedback on the agenda consultation. But in any case, based on the feedback, it is clear that it involves, in many cases, material operations, especially in some industries, and that is divesting practice, and I believe we should help to find a solution to bring guidance and consistency to this area. Thank you.
Thank you, Tadeo. Over to you, Mary.
Okay. I commented about collaborative arrangements in kind of my overall overview comments, because that was one of the topics that kind of stood out of, you know, above the horizon across all these papers. As I said then, I have some question about how, if there's not a legal entity, you think that it's a faithful representation to show a proportion of the whole when it's a contractual arrangement, or of some kind, either written or not even written, you know, not even written, just agreed or practiced. Having expressed that skepticism, I'm now going to be glad that we're meeting virtually rather than in person, because I'm going to raise a comment that Sue might throw something at me if we were in the same room. And that is, you know, with the questions that we got about collaborative arrangements, I think the first question we have to answer is, how do we think current requirements apply to things with kind of typical characteristics of collaborative arrangements, i.e. work through the application of existing requirements? And the reason I cited Sue and the potential for things flying across the boardroom is because of her chairmanship of interpretation committee, and whether that's something that usefully could be considered by the interpretation committee, because I think it's only once we think through an analysis of how existing standards apply to typical features of a collaborative arrangement that we can assess whether we think that standard setting is warranted in that area. And then in something that may be a bit related to that, given my what seems to be focus on legal entities. Paragraph 21 of this paper had a comment about it being difficult to override the legal form. I mean, when I think that overall the views that we got back seem to be that IFRS 11 is working, I don't see this, not only do I not see it as being worth reopening, I actually would be opposed to that, in part for some of the reasons Anne cited about practice having been established. You know, Rika made the comment about the importance of consistency in an entity's approach to some of these issues. And I think, you know, in the context of the consideration of application questions by the interpretation committee for the series of agenda decisions that they did relating to IFRS 11, this is one of the issues considered. And that, you know, that brought a lot of scrutiny and a lot of different experience to bear on those questions. And I don't know how much this is I would like a different answer, therefore I am asking for this, as opposed to I don't know how to do it. So my reaction is, in paragraph 21's comment, to not try and readdress that. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, very clear. Bertrand.
Thank you, Andreas. I was about to make a comment on some interpretations committee's agenda decisions that were issued before I was a member of the interpretations committee, and before Sue began to chair the interpretations committee, by the way. There had been some agenda decision in the time relating to IFRS 11 that always surprised me. If you think of the thing that way, you may well end up consolidating an entity without owning any share. But the agenda decisions makes it clear that if you don't in a sense own any share on a joint arrangement, if it's, and notably if it's an unincorporated entity, then it can only be a joint operation, and it cannot be a joint venture. And this has always surprised me, this outcome, because I don't think that is very principle based. It's something that is based on the legal form of the entity. And if you were to consider control in IFRS 10, you may well end up with a very different answer. That's the only thing that, I mean, in practice, of course, it works, but the distinction is odd. In the sense that then you have just an appreciation of the legal form of the arrangement to determine at first whether it's a joint operation or not. And it's only when there is an incorporated entity that you ask yourself the question whether it's a joint venture or a joint operation. It's the only piece of agenda decision that I would, if we were to consider eventually analyzing a bit further those, I would like the staff to further analyze so as to see whether we can reach a similar conclusion, but with a more substantial approach relating to the principle-based standards.
Thank you, Bertrand. Over to you, Anne.
Thanks, Andreas. I'd like to comment on proportionate consolidation. There's a comment in this paper, paragraph 59. Some respondents say that there's more useful information from that. I think this is one of the fundamental issues that we should not be revisiting. It was explored in depth during the center setting process. In paragraph 49, we have a comment from the AASB letter that says that they heard users say that proportionate consolidation gives more useful information. So a key element to this is what the disclosures are like, because when the board was making IFRS 11, the idea was that the disclosures would provide information that previously people got from proportional consolidation. So looking at the user feedback in the 7C slide deck, we see that the staff tell us that the feedback's mixed. Some users said that the disclosures are useful and sufficient, and indeed I was in outreach meetings where I heard that comment from users. However, the note is also there that other users are not satisfied. And we do get some insight on this from the academic research. So in paper 7D, we have a study that's quite helpful in this, because this is a very specific study that looks at disclosure by a relatively large sample, more than 500 companies, and they are drawn from 26 countries. So it's excellent in terms of its spread. And that academic research is very specific, looking at whether the entities are providing the disclosure points as required by IFRS 12 in relation to that information that should be provided about joint ventures. What those results tell us that there's a median result of 100%. That means the most common result for these sample companies is 100% of disclosures. So that's why some users could be satisfied. However, there is the average result about 65%. So that tells us that for some entities, they're not disclosing well. And for some countries, it's a very jurisdictional thing. So for some countries, they're not disclosing well. So I would like to suggest that perhaps there's some education material that we could provide on this, because we've got good feedback through our own outreach and through the academic work that could could help us to produce one of our education type statements around this. I'd just like to suggest that that's something we could consider for this issue. Thank you.
Thanks, Anne, for pointing that out. Zach.
I'm just going to say that Anne stole my thunder. That's exactly what I was going to say, less eloquently. But just going back to those meetings with users, the only additional point, and I think this also came up in the IFRS 12 comments in paragraph 38 and 39, was the frequent input when we showed model disclosures that, yes, that's the information we need, but that's not what we always see. And I think it's worth it for us, whether it's in the context of the PIR or as part of the larger disclosure project, to take a look at that and say, okay, we have disclosure requirements and we're getting feedback that that's not what's being produced. Why is that? And that can become part of our feedback loop for future disclosures, to understand when we create a standard and the disclosure requirements aren't met, why? And when they are met, what have we done differently? That's it.
Thank you, Zach. Let's hear from Tom.
Yeah, a very quick comment. I'm generally agreed that we shouldn't be reacting unduly. This goes more to how we might react. Just when we did the extractive discussion, we'd also touched on pharmaceuticals, and I noticed in paragraph 8, where are these arrangements widespread for collaborative? One of the things we said that was problematic was that risk-sharing arrangements, it's not obvious that IFRS reports the most useful possible information one could envision to users about risk sharing arrangements between entities. And I think I almost see this as outside if you wanted to do something for collaborative that would really increase the quality of the information. It almost sounds like a separate project. Is what? How do you report on risk sharing arrangements between entities? They take a variety of types. They're not really focused so much on who controls the assets, because almost by definition, when you're risk sharing, there's this shared control, which is why this model might break down. So I, with regard to this PIR, I would do nothing, but I put a marker that if one really has concerns, it's probably some kind of a separate project on with respect to how do you deal with risk sharing between enterprises.
Thank you, Tom. Finally, Rika.
Andres, thank you. I just build on what Mary already mentioned about the collaborative arrangement. I really think there is no specific definition or commonly used definition about the collaborative arrangement. And what I've seen in the practice is I haven't seen the kind of the typical function features of these arrangements that majority of collaborative arrangement commonly have. So that means it's probably very difficult to determine the scope to address the issues in accounting standards, particularly about how to account for those arrangements. It's quite dependent on the features included in the collaborative arrangement, as well as the facts and the circumstances between the related parties involved in this arrangement. So I think it's quite difficult for us to address. That's my thought. Thank you.
Thank you. And Jen, you want to come in regarding collaborative arrangements?
Yeah, so during the course of this project, we as a team realized the difficulty mentioned by Rika about how to identify the common features of the collaborative arrangement. But because we use collaborative arrangement just for a term in the request for information, it's not a defined term in the standard. It's not a defined term among the different stakeholders. So if we are to suggest this as a separate project, we would suggest to try to find a meaningful way to define the scope of the standard, define a common feature of this collaboration first, before talking about the accounting treatment of these arrangements. That's my comment. Thank you.
Thank you. With that, can I open the floor for comments regarding IFRS 12 disclosures? Bruce, please.
Thanks very much. I mean, I guess on the IFRS 12 stuff, the one I just wanted to comment on, and I know it was mentioned earlier, some people commented on the identifying the unconsolidated structured entities. I will say that I think something that we really do need to look at regarding that is the disclosures around those. I mean, I think a lot of people I've spoken to find it quite punitive. I mean, they're saying, you know, we've kind of bypassed quite a big hurdle in that we don't have control, hence we're not consolidating it. And yet they found that then having to put in quite a lot of those disclosures were becoming quite onerous for them. So just something I think I'd like to, I think we need to unpack a bit more. Thanks.
Thank you. And I certainly agree that I've heard that comment as well. Bertrand, you had a question regarding paper 7C. Go ahead, please.
Yes, if the staff could elaborate a bit more on the comment they make on page 26 of agenda paper 7C, what is it about these feedback received from users? It's relating to joint ventures and associates in segment reporting. Many users said it would be helpful if financial statements included information on the share of joint ventures or associates' contribution to a particular line item, for example, revenue of joint ventures.
because during the outreach with users, we use some of the examples we find in the practice, because some of the preparers disclose in their segment reporting share of certain items, for example, share the revenue of its material. I'm not sure whether it's material or not, but material joint ventures and associates, and to be included in the separate segment revenue. So we ask the question, do they actually frequently see this kind of information, or are they useful for them to in their evaluation model? And the response is because basically, yes, they will welcome these kind of information to be disclosed.
But this information is disclosed as a non-GAAP measure then?
Yeah. Yeah,
because otherwise, I was not quite understanding the point raised, because the disclosures requirements require a preparer to disclose the summarized financials of the joint ventures or the associates when it's significant in the notes, the financial statement. And of course, you disclose also the proportionate share. So I would think that it's rather simple to perform the calculation. So what you're saying is the presentation within the segment reporting disclosure of specific line items. But then obviously it would be a non-GAAP measure, not purely a GAAP measure, I would say.
Yeah, the only difference between the summarized financial information, if you're going to do a calculation, is because the joint venture is not disclosed on the segmental level, segment basis. So this is the only difference.
Well, I would nuance a bit what you said in saying that I think the information exists, but it's spread throughout a couple of disclosures within the notes and financial statements of preparers. The information is there, basically. So it's just about the choice of a preparer of presenting a specific non-GAAP measure or not when they think that they have a significant joint venture or significant associate for which they would like to present something specific in their segment reporting. Thank you. Well understood then. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you. Mary and Nick. Mary, please.
And an observation, I want to check my understanding partly of what Bruce, said, and you seconded, Andreas, about potential costs in excess of benefits of certain disclosures, and trying to marry that up with the observation that we had before. And I think I had some of the same experiences as Zach of doing outreach with users where, we said, so this is, here's an example of what we expect disclosures that satisfy IFRS 12 requirements are. Are these adequate for you? And the user saying they would be, but that's not what we're getting, which suggests compliance issue. How, if we're all talking about the same thing, how can we be talking about there's too high a cost for not useful information, but not getting the information that we would expect from the examples? Now, it may be, that was the conclusion we reached as we started out on our journey with the disclosure initiative. It's too much boilerplate and not enough specific information that's useful. So again, one of the things I think about is if it's a compliance issue, we should be alerting enforcers, and that's, both regulators and auditors. And it might also be an area for which some educational material, as opposed to guidance added to the standard, might be useful in terms of getting, leveling up, as the phrase goes, in terms of expectations about disclosures pursuant to existing requirements. But I wanted to flag for the staff that there seems to be a bit of tension and different perspectives and views around this. So I think we probably have to start up by figuring out which problem we're trying to solve before we can assess whether or not we should be trying to do something.
Which is always useful. Bruce, you want to respond?
Yeah, that's just responding to Mary. I mean, Mary, I think I actually agree with you. I mean, I think there's a number of different places I've got comment on this. I mean, from a preparer point of view, for those of us who I think have complied quite well, they're saying that it's quite a lot of information to put in there that they have to do. I think from the users, from a user's perspective, I think that there's maybe an expectation gap in terms of what they're expecting, and I think what the preparers are giving in terms of that. And I do think that in the middle of that is a compliance area. I think you're right, because maybe that it's not really the compliance of those. I tell you where I think it's become a big issue on enforcement and compliance is that the problem with unconsolidated structured entities is you can kind of only judge people on what's there. It's difficult to work out what's not there. Because these are unconsolidated. So if you've just taken the decision that they're not there or you're not putting it in, then there's nothing there. And I think that's been one of the challenges that's come in on that. So I actually agree with what you're saying. I think we first need to maybe unpack that a little bit more in terms of what are people saying. Is it just that they're saying, looking at the requirements, we think those are too onerous? Or are we saying that, well, actually, if I applied those requirements, I'm not, from a user point of view, I'm not getting what I want? Or the regulators are saying, we just don't think there's enough in there to help us enforce what people should be in there. So I actually agree. I think we do need to unpack that from different perspectives.
Okay, well said. Nick?
Thanks. So really, first of all, just to follow up on Bertrand's question around segment information, and I was at some of those meetings where we shared examples, and I'd say clearly users found that presentation attractive. Segments are often the foundation for analysis, and even though this was non-GAAP, I think many of them found it presented in an intuitive manner that they could easily input to their analysis. The other comment I wanted to make about IFRS 12 disclosures is some of the feedback that's picked up in the slide deck on the outreach activities that staff undertook. And here, in particular, around summarized financial information. And the comments that I see here are really comparable with some of the issues that we've picked up in the PIR of IFRS 3. And so a good example would be a requirement to disclose current and non-current liabilities, when actually what users are really interested in is borrowings. And so, you know, you do get these overriding aggregated disclosures around current and non-current liabilities, but doesn't quite get to the information that the users are looking for. Clearly, our proposals in relation to IFRS 3 address that issue specifically, but I think that's it's the degree to which information is being summarized, and there's a phrase in the deck asking for more granular summarized information. That's not a contradiction in terms, but I think that is the essence of the request.
Thank you, Nick. Can I ask whether any further board members wish to come in on IFRS 12? That doesn't seem to be the case. I think we have had quite a good discussion, and I suppose that the team got some very good feedback. Can I circle it back to you for any final comments, Jen, Wenji, or Michelle, that you may have?
I will say thank you, board members, for your inputs, comments, and experience on these topics. And as I said before, in the tee up, we will consider your inputs and come back to the future meeting to make our suggestions.
Super, excellent. Okay, we are 2 minutes ahead of time, but I think that won't hurt. I suggest that we do make a break and reconvene at 1:45. Thank you.